who'd gambled everything they have on a horse, or the Tarletons, who'd turn out a drunkard or two in every litter, or the Fontaines, who are hot-headed little brutes and after murdering a man for a fancied slight. That kind of queerness is easy to understand, for sure, and but for the grace of God, Gerald O'Hara would be having all those faults. And I don't mean that Ashley would run off with another woman, if you were his wife, or beat you. You'd be happier if you did, for at least you'd be understanding that. But he's queer in other ways, and there's no understanding him at all. I like him, but it's neither heads nor tails I can make of most he says. Now, Puss, tell me true. Do you understand his folderol about books and poetry and music and oil paintings and such foolishness?
Oh, Pa, cried Scarlet impatiently. If I married him, I'd change all that.
Oh, you would you now?
Said Gerald testily, shooting a sharp look at her.
Then it's little enough you are known of any man living, let alone Ashley. No wife has ever changed a husband one whit, and don't you be forgetting that. And as for changing a Wilkes, God's nightgown, daughter! The whole family is that way, and they've always been that way, and probably always will. I tell you, they're born queer. Look at the way they go tearing up to New York and Boston to hear operas and see oil paintings, and ordering French and German books by the crate from the Yankees. And there they sit reading and dreaming the dear God knows what, when they'd be better spending their time hunting and playing poker as proper men should.
There's nobody in the county sits a horse better than Ashley, said Scarlet, furious at the slur of effeminacy flung on Ashley. Nobody except maybe his father. And as for poker, didn't Ashley take $200 away from you just last week in Jonesboro?
The Calvert boys have been blabbing again, Gerald said resignedly. Else you'd not be knowing the amount. Ashley can ride with the best and play poker with the best. That's me, Puss. And I'm not denying that when he sets out to drink, he can even put the Tarletons under the table. He can do all those things. But his heart's not in it. That's why I say he's queer.
Scarlet was silent, and her heart sank. She could think of no defense for this last, for she knew Gerald was right. Ashley's heart was in none of the pleasant things he did so well. He was never more than politely interested in any of the things that vitally interested everyone else. Rightly interpreting her silence, Gerald patted her arm and said triumphantly,
"There now, Scarlet, you admit 'tis true. What would you be doing with a husband like Ashley? 'Tis moonstruck they all are, all the Wilkes." And then in a wheedling tone, "When I was mentioning the Tarletons the while ago, I wasn't pushing them. They're fine, lads. But if it's Cade Calvert you're setting your cap after, why, 'tis the same with me. The Calverts are good folk, all of them, for all the old man marrying a Yankee. And when I'm gone, whist, darling, listen to me. I'll leave Tara to you and Cade—"
"I wouldn't have Cade on a silver tray," cried Scarlet in fury. "And I wish you'd quit pushing him at me. I don't want Tara or any old plantation. Plantations don't amount to anything when—" She was going to say, "when you haven't the man you want." But Gerald, incensed by the cavalier way in which she treated his proffered gift, the thing which next to Ellen he loved best in the whole world, uttered a roar. "Do you stand there, Scarlet O'Hara, and tell me that Tara, that land, doesn't amount to anything?" Scarlet nodded obstinately. Her heart was too sore to care whether or not she put her father in a temper. "Land is the only thing in the world that amounts to anything," he shouted, his thick, short arms making wide gestures of indignation.
for 'tis the only thing in this world that lasts, and don't you be forgetting it. 'Tis the only thing worth working for, worth fighting for, worth dying for.
Oh, Pa, she said disgustedly, you talk like an Irishman.
Have I ever been ashamed of it? No, 'tis proud I am. And don't be forgetting that you are half Irish, miss. And to anyone with a drop of Irish blood in them, the land they live on is like their mother. 'Tis ashamed of you I am this minute. I offer you the most beautiful land in the world, saving County Meath in the old country, and what do? You sniff.
Gerald had begun to work himself up into a pleasurable shouting rage, when something in Scarlett's woebegone face stopped him.
But there, you're young. 'Twill come to you, this love of land. There's no getting away from it, if you're Irish. You're just a child and bothered about your beaus. When you're older, you'll be seeing how 'tis. Now, do you be making up your mind about Cade or the twins or one of Evan Munro's young bucks, and see how fine I turn you out.
Oh, Pa! By this time, Gerald was thoroughly tired of the conversation and thoroughly annoyed that the problem should be upon his shoulders. He felt aggrieved, moreover, that Scarlett should still look desolate after being offered the best of the county boys and Tara, too. Gerald liked his gifts to be received with clapping of hands and kisses.
"Now none of your pouts, miss. It doesn't matter who you marry, as long as he thinks like you and is a gentleman and a southerner and prideful. For a woman, love comes after marriage."
"Oh, Pa, that is such an old country notion."
"And a good notion it is. All this American business of running around marrying for love like servants, like Yankees. The best marriages are when the parents choose for the girl. For how can a silly piece like yourself tell a good man from a scoundrel? Now look at the Wilkes. What's kept them prideful and strong all these generations? Why, marrying the likes of themselves. Marrying the cousins their family always expects them to marry."
"Oh," cried Scarlett, fresh pain striking her as Gerald's words brought home the terrible inevitability of the truth. Gerald looked at her bowed head and shuffled his feet uneasily.
"It's not crying you are," he questioned, fumbling clumsily at her chin, trying to turn her face upward, his own face furrowed with pity.
"No,"
she cried vehemently, jerking away. "It's lying you are, and I'm proud of it. I'm glad there's pride in you, puss. And I want to see pride in you tomorrow at the barbecue. I'll not be having the county gossiping and laughing at you for mooning your heart out about a man who never gave you a thought beyond friendship."
"He did give me a thought," thought Scarlett, sorrowfully in her heart. "Oh, a lot of thoughts. I know he did. I could tell. If I'd just had a little longer, I know I could have made him say... Oh, if it only wasn't that the Wilkes always feel that they have to marry their cousins."
Gerald took her arm and passed it through his. "We'll be going into supper now, and all this is between us. I'll not be worrying your mother with this, nor do you do it either. Blow your nose, daughter."
Scarlett blew her nose on her torn handkerchief, and they started up the dark drive arm in arm, the horse following slowly. Near the house, Scarlett was at the point of speaking again when she saw her mother in the dim shadows of the porch. She had on her bonnet, shawl, and mittens, and behind her was Mammy, her face like a thundercloud, holding in her hand the black leather bag in which Ellen O'Hara always carried the bandages and medicine she used in doctoring the slaves. Mammy's lips were large and pendulous and when indignant, She could push out her lower one to twice its normal length. It was pushed out now. And Scarlet knew that Mammy was seething over something of which she did not approve.
"Mr. O'Hara," called Ellen as she saw the two coming up the driveway. Ellen belonged to a generation that was formal, even after 17 years of wedlock and the bearing of 6 children. "Mr. O'Hara, there is illness at the Slattery house. Emmy's baby has been born and is dying and must be baptized. I'm going there with Mammy to see what I can do."
Her voice was raised questioningly, as though she hung on Gerald's assent to her plan, a mere formality but one dear to the heart of Gerald.
"In the name of God," blustered Gerald, "why should those white trash take you away just at your supper hour, and just when I'm wanting to tell you about the war talk that's going on in Atlanta?"
"Go, Mrs. O'Hara. You'd not rest easy on your pillow the night if there was trouble abroad and you're not there to help."
"She don't never get no rest on a pillow for hopping up at night time nursing niggers and poor white trash dat could tend to deself,"
grumbled Mammy, in a monotone, as she went down the stairs toward the carriage, which was waiting in the side drive.
"Take my place at the table, dear," said Ellen, patting Scarlet's cheek softly with a mittened hand. In spite of her choked back tears, Scarlet thrilled to the never-failing magic of her mother's touch, to the faint fragrance of lemon verbena sachet that came from her rustling silk dress. To Scarlet, there was something breathtaking about Ellen O'Hara, a miracle that lived in the house with her and awed her and charmed and soothed her. Gerald helped his wife into the carriage and gave orders to the coachman to drive carefully. Toby, who had handled Gerald's horses for 20 years, pushed out his lips in mute indignation at being told how to conduct his own business. Driving off, with Mammy beside him, each was a perfect picture of pouting African disapproval.
"If I didn't do so much for those trashy Slatteries that they'd have to pay money for elsewhere," fumed Gerald, "they'd be willing to sell me their miserable few acres of swamp bottom, and the county would be well rid of them."
Then, brightening, in anticipation of one of his practical jokes,
"Come, daughter, let's go tell Pork that instead of buying Dilsey, I've sold him to John Wilkes."
He tossed the reins of his horse to a small pickaninny standing near and started up the steps. He had already forgotten Scarlet's heartbreak, and his mind was only on plaguing his valet. Scarlet slowly climbed the steps after him, her feet leaden. She thought that, after all, a mating between herself and Ashley could be no queerer than that of her father and Ellen Robillard O'Hara. As always, she wondered how her loud, insensitive father had managed to marry a woman like her mother, for never were two people further apart in birth, breeding, and habits of mind.
Chapter 3. Ellen O'Hara was 32 years old. And according to the standards of her day, she was a middle-aged woman, one who had borne 6 children and buried 3. She was a tall woman, standing a head higher than her fiery little husband, but she moved with such quiet grace in her swaying hoops that her height attracted no attention to itself. Her neck, rising from the black taffeta sheath of her basque, was creamy-skinned, rounded and slender, and it seemed always tilted slightly backward by the weight of her luxuriant hair in its net at the back of her head. From her French mother, whose parents had fled Haiti in the revolution of 1791, had come her slanting dark eyes, shadowed by inky lashes, and her black hair. And from her father, a soldier of Napoleon. She had her long, straight nose and her square-cut jaw that was softened by the gentle curving of her cheeks. But only from life could Ellen's face have acquired its look of pride that had no haughtiness, its graciousness, its melancholy, and its utter lack of humor. She would have been a strikingly beautiful woman had there been any glow in her eyes, any responsive warmth in her smile, or any spontaneity in her voice that fell with gentle melody on the ears of her family and her servants. She spoke in the soft, slurring voice of the coastal Georgian, liquid of vowels, kind to consonants, and with the barest trace of French accent. It was a voice never raised in command to a servant, or reproof to a child, but a voice that was obeyed instantly at Terra, where her husband's blustering and roaring were quietly disregarded. As far back as Scarlet could remember, her mother had always been the same, her voice soft and sweet, whether in praising or in reproving, her manner efficient and unruffled despite the daily emergencies of Gerald's turbulent household, her spirit always calm and her back unbowed, even in the deaths of her three baby sons. Scarlet had never seen her mother's back touch the back of any chair on which she sat. Nor had she ever seen her sit down without a bit of needlework in her hands, except at mealtime, while attending the sick, or while working at the bookkeeping of the plantation. It was delicate embroidery, if company were present, but at other times her hands were occupied with Gerald's ruffled shirts, the girls' dresses, or garments for the slaves. Scarlet could not imagine her mother's hands without her gold thimble, or her rustling figure unaccompanied by the small Negro girl whose sole function in life was to remove basting threads and carry the rosewood sewing box from room to room, as Ellen moved about the house superintending the cooking, the cleaning, and the wholesale clothes-making for the plantation. She had never seen her mother stirred from her austere placidity, nor her personal appointments anything but perfect, no matter what the hour of day or night. When Ellen was dressing for a ball, or for guests, or even to go to Jonesboro for court day, it frequently required 2 hours, 2 maids, and Mammy to turn her out to her own satisfaction. But her swift toilets in times of emergency were amazing. Scarlet, whose room lay across the hall from her mother's, knew from babyhood the soft sound of scurrying bare black feet on the hardwood floor in the hours of dawn, the urgent tappings on her mother's door, and the muffled, frightened Negro voices that whispered of sickness and birth and death in the long row of whitewashed cabins in the quarters. As a child, she had often crept to the door and, peeping through the tiniest crack, had seen Ellen emerge from the dark room, where Gerald's snores were rhythmic and untroubled, into the flickering light of an upheld candle, her medicine case under her arm, her hair smoothed neatly into place, and no button on her basque unlooped. It had always been so soothing to Scarlet to hear her mother whisper, firmly but compassionately, as she tiptoed down the hall, "Hush, not so loudly. You will wake Mr. O'Hara. They are not sick enough to die." Yes, it was good to creep back into bed and know that Ellen was abroad in the night and everything was right. In the mornings, after all-night sessions at births and deaths, when old Dr. Fontaine and young Dr. Fontaine were both out on calls and could not be found to help her, Ellen presided at the breakfast table as usual. Her dark eyes circled with weariness, but her voice and manner revealing none of the strain. There was a steely quality under her stately gentleness that awed the whole household, Gerald as well as the girls, though he would have died rather than admit it. Sometimes, when Scarlet tiptoed at night to kiss her tall mother's cheek,
She looked up at the mouth with its too short, too tender upper lip, a mouth too easily hurt by the world, and wondered if it had ever curved in silly, girlish giggling, or whispered secrets through long nights to intimate girlfriends. But no, that wasn't possible. Mother had always been just as she was, a pillar of strength, a fount of wisdom. The one person who knew the answers to everything. But Scarlet was wrong. For years before, Ellen Robillard of Savannah had giggled as inexplicably as any 15-year-old in that charming coastal city, and whispered the long nights through with friends, exchanging confidences, telling all secrets but one. That was the year when Gerald O'Hara, 28 years older than she, came into her life. The year, too, when youth and her black-eyed cousin, Philippe Robillard, went out of it. For when Philippe, with his snapping eyes and his wild ways, left Savannah forever, he took with him the glow that was in Ellen's heart, and left for the bandy-legged little Irishman who married her, only a gentle shell. But that was enough for Gerald, overwhelmed at his unbelievable luck in actually marrying her. And if anything was gone from her, he never missed it. Shrewd man that he was, he knew it was no less than a miracle that he, an Irishman with nothing of family and wealth to recommend him, should win the daughter of one of the wealthiest and proudest families on the coast. For Gerald was a self-made man. Gerald had come to America from Ireland when he was 21. He had come hastily, as many a better and worse Irishman before and since, with the clothes he had on his back, 2 shillings above his passage money, and a price on his head that he felt was larger than his misdeed warranted. There was no Orangeman this side of hell worth £100 to the British government or to the devil himself. But if the government felt so strongly about the death of an English absentee landlord's rent agent, it was time for Gerald O'Hara to be leaving, and leaving suddenly. True, he had called the rent agent a bastard of an Orangeman, but that, according to Gerald's way of looking at it, did not give the man any right to insult him by whistling the opening bars of the Boyne Water. The Battle of the Boyne had been fought more than 100 years before, but to the O'Haras and their neighbors, it might have been yesterday when their hopes and dreams, as well as their lands and wealth, went off in the same cloud of dust that enveloped a frightened and fleeing Stuart prince. Leaving William of Orange and his hated troops with their orange cockades to cut down the Irish adherents of the Stuarts. For this and other reasons, Gerald's family was not inclined to view the fatal outcome of his quarrel as anything very serious, except for the fact that it was charged with serious consequences. For years, the O'Haras had been in bad odor with the English constabulary on account of suspected activities against the government. And Gerald was not the first O'Hara to take his foot in his hand and quit Ireland between dawn and morning. His 2 oldest brothers, James and Andrew, he hardly remembered, save as close-lipped youths who came and went at odd hours of the night on mysterious errands, or disappeared for weeks at a time, to their mother's gnawing anxiety. They had come to America years before, after the discovery of a small arsenal of rifles buried under the O'Hara pigsty. Now they were successful merchants in Savannah, though the dear God alone knows where that may be, as their mother always interpolated when mentioning the 2 oldest of her male brood, and it was to them that young Gerald was sent. He left home with his mother's hasty kiss on his cheek and her fervent Catholic blessing in his ears, and his father's parting admonition. "Remember who you are, and don't be taking nothing off no man."
His five tall brothers gave him goodbye with admiring but slightly patronizing smiles, for Gerald was the baby, and the little one of a brawny family. His five brothers and their father stood 6 feet and over and broad in proportion. But little Gerald, at 21, knew that 5 feet 4 1/2 inches was as much as the Lord in his wisdom was going to allow him. It was like Gerald that he never wasted regrets on his lack of height, and never found it an obstacle to his acquisition of anything he wanted. Rather, it was Gerald's compact smallness that made him what he was. For he had learned early that little people must be hardy to survive among large ones. And Gerald was hardy. His tall brothers were a grim, quiet lot, in whom the family tradition of past glories lost forever, rankled in unspoken hate and crackled out in bitter humor. Had Gerald been brawny, he would have gone the way of the other O'Haras and moved quietly and darkly among the rebels against the government. But Gerald was loud-mouthed and bull-headed, as his mother fondly phrased it. Hair-trigger of temper, quick with his fists, and possessed of a chip on his shoulder so large as to be almost visible to the naked eye. He swaggered among the tall O'Haras like a strutting bantam in a barnyard of giant Cochin roosters, and they loved him, baited him affectionately to hear him roar, and hammered on him with their large fists, no more than was necessary to keep a baby brother in his proper place. If the educational equipment which Gerald brought to America was scant, he did not even know it, nor would he have cared if he had been told. His mother had taught him to read and to write a clear hand. He was adept at ciphering. And there his book knowledge stopped. The only Latin he knew was the responses of the Mass, and the only history, the manifold wrongs of Ireland. He knew no poetry save that of Moore, and no music except the songs of Ireland that had come down through the years. While he entertained the liveliest respect for those who had more book learning than he never felt his own lack. And what need had he of these things in a new country where the most ignorant of bog-trotters had made great fortunes? In this country which asked only that a man be strong and unafraid of work. Nor did James and Andrew, who took him into their store in Savannah, regret his lack of education. His clear hand, his accurate figures, and his shrewd ability in bargaining won their respect, where a knowledge of literature and fine appreciation of music, had young Gerald possessed them, would have moved them to snorts of contempt. America, in the early years of the century, had been kind to the Irish. James and Andrew, who had begun by hauling goods in covered wagons from Savannah to Georgia's inland towns, had prospered in a store of their own, and Gerald prospered with them. He liked the South, and he soon became, in his own opinion, a Southerner. There was much about the South and Southerners that he would never comprehend, but with the wholeheartedness that was his nature, he adopted its ideas and customs, as he understood them, for his own. Poker and horse racing, red-hot politics, and the code duello, states' rights, and damnation to all Yankees, slavery and King Cotton, contempt for white trash, and exaggerated courtesy to women. He even learned to chew tobacco. There was no need for him to acquire a good head for whiskey. He had been born with one. But Gerald remained Gerald. His habits of living and his ideas changed, but his manners he would not change, even had he been able to change them. He admired the drawling elegance of the wealthy rice and cotton planters who rode into Savannah from their moss-hung kingdoms, mounted on thoroughbred horses, and followed by the carriages of their equally elegant ladies and the wagons of their slaves. But Gerald could never attain elegance.
Their lazy, blurred voices fell pleasantly on his ears, but his own brisk brogue clung to his tongue. He liked the casual grace with which they conducted affairs of importance, risking a fortune, a plantation or a slave, on the turn of a card, and writing off their losses with careless good humour, and no more ado than when they scattered pennies to pickaninnies. But Gerald had known poverty, and he could never learn to lose money with good humour or good grace. They were a pleasant race, these coastal Georgians, with their soft-voiced, quick rages and their charming inconsistencies, and Gerald liked them. But there was a brisk and restless vitality about the young Irishman, fresh from a country where winds blew wet and chill, where misty swamps held no fevers, that set him apart from these indolent gentlefolk of semi-tropical weather and malarial marshes. From them he learned what he found useful, and the rest he dismissed. He found poker the most useful of all southern customs, poker and a steady head for whiskey. And it was his natural aptitude for cards and amber liquor that brought to Gerald two of his three most prized possessions, his valet and his plantation. The other was his wife, and he could only attribute her to the mysterious kindness of God. The valet, Pork by name, shining black, dignified and trained in all the arts of sartorial elegance, was the result of an all-night poker game with a planter from St. Simon's Island, whose courage in a bluff equaled Gerald's, but whose head for New Orleans rum did not. Though Pork's former owner later offered to buy him back at twice his value, Gerald obstinately refused, for the possession of his first slave, and that slave the best damn valet on the coast, was the first step upward toward his heart's desire. Gerald wanted to be a slave owner and a landed gentleman. His mind was made up that he was not going to spend all of his days like James and Andrew in bargaining, or all his nights by candlelight over long columns of figures. He felt keenly, as his brothers did not, the social stigma attached to those in trade. Gerald wanted to be a planter. With the deep hunger of an Irishman who has been a tenant on the lands his people once had owned and hunted, he wanted to see his own acres stretching green before his eyes. With a ruthless singleness of purpose, he desired his own house, his own plantation, his own horse, his own slaves. And here in this new country, safe from the twin perils of the land he had left, taxation that ate up crops and barns, and the ever-present threat of sudden confiscation, he intended to have them. But having that ambition and bringing it to realization were two different matters, he discovered as time went by. Coastal Georgia was too firmly held by an entrenched aristocracy for him to ever hope to win the place he intended to have. Then the hand of fate and a hand of poker combined to give him the plantation, which he afterwards called Terra, and at the same time moved him out of the coast into the upland country of North Georgia. It was in a saloon in Savannah, on a hot night in spring, when the chance conversation of a stranger sitting nearby made Gerald prick up his ears. The stranger, a native of Savannah, had just returned after 12 years in the inland country. He had been one of the winners in the land lottery conducted by the state to divide up the vast area in middle Georgia, ceded by the Indians the year before Gerald came to America. He had gone up there and established a plantation, but now the house had burned down, he was tired of the accursed place, and would be most happy to get it off his hands. Gerald, his mind never free of the thought of owning a plantation of his own, arranged an introduction, And his interest grew as the stranger told how the northern section of the state was filling up with newcomers from the Carolinas and Virginia. Gerald had lived in Savannah long enough to acquire the viewpoint of the coast, that all of the rest of the state was backwoods, with an Indian lurking in every thicket. In transacting business for O'Hara Brothers, he had visited Augusta, 100 miles up the Savannah River, and he had traveled inland far enough to visit the old towns westward from that city. He knew that section to be as well settled as the coast, but from the stranger's description, his plantation was more than 250 miles inland from Savannah to the north and west, and not many miles south of the Chattahoochee River. Gerald knew that northward, beyond that stream, the land was still held by the Cherokees. So it was with amazement that he heard the stranger jeer at suggestions of trouble with the Indians, and narrate how thriving towns were growing up and plantations prospering in the new country. An hour later, when the conversation began to lag, Gerald, with a guile that belied the wide innocence of his bright blue eyes, proposed a game. As the night wore on and the drinks went round, there came a time when all the others in the game laid down their hands and Gerald and the stranger were battling alone. The stranger shoved in all his chips and followed with the deed to his plantation. Gerald shoved in all his chips and laid on top of them his wallet. If the money it contained happened to belong to the firm of O'Hara Brothers, Gerald's conscience was not sufficiently troubled to confess it before Mass the following morning. He knew what he wanted, and when Gerald wanted something, he gained it by taking the most direct route. Moreover, such was his faith in his destiny and four deuces that he never for a moment wondered just how the money would be paid back should a higher hand be laid down across the table.
"It's no bargain you're getting, and I'm glad not to have to pay more taxes on the place," sighed the possessor of an ace full, as he called for pen and ink. "The big house burned a year ago, and the fields are growing up in brush and seedling pine. But it's yours."
"Never mix cards and whiskey, unless you are weaned on Irish poteen," Gerald told Pork gravely the same evening, as Pork assisted him to bed. And the valet, who had begun to attempt a brogue out of admiration for his new master, made requisite answer in a combination of Geechee and County Meath that would have puzzled anyone except those two alone. The muddy Flint River, running silently between walls of pine and water oak covered with tangled vines, wrapped about Gerald's new land like a curving arm and embraced it on two sides. To Gerald, standing on the small knoll where the house had been, this tall barrier of green was as visible and pleasing an evidence of ownership as though it were a fence that he himself had built to mark his own. He stood on the blackened foundation stones of the burned building, looked down the long avenue of trees leading toward the road, and swore lustily, with a joy too deep for thankful prayer. These twin lines of somber trees were his. His the abandoned lawn, waist high in weeds under white-starred young magnolia trees. The uncultivated fields, studded with tiny pines and underbrush, that stretched their rolling red clay surface away into the distance on four sides, belonged to Gerald O'Hara, were all his because he had an unbefuddled Irish head and the courage to stake everything on a hand of cards. Gerald closed his eyes and, in the stillness of the unworked acres, he felt that he had come home. Here under his feet would rise a house of whitewashed brick. Across the road would be new rail fences, enclosing fat cattle and blooded horses, and the red earth that rolled down the hillside to the rich river-bottom land would gleam white as eiderdown in the sun. Cotton, acres and acres of cotton. The fortunes of the O'Haras would rise again. With his own small stake, what he could borrow from his unenthusiastic brothers, and a neat sum from mortgaging the land, Gerald bought his first field hands and came to Tara to live in bachelor solitude in the four-room overseer's house till such a time as the white walls of Tara should rise. He cleared the fields and planted cotton and borrowed more money from James and Andrew to buy more slaves. The O'Haros were a clannish tribe, clinging to one another in prosperity as well as in adversity, not for any overweening family affection, but because they had learned through grim years that to survive a family must present an unbroken front to the world. They lent Gerald the money, and in the years that followed, the money came back to them with interest. Gradually, the plantation widened out, as Gerald bought more acres lying near him, and in time the White House became a reality instead of a dream. It was built by slave labor, a clumsy, sprawling building that crowned the rise of ground overlooking the green incline of pasture land running down to the river. And it pleased Gerald greatly, for, even when new, it wore a look of mellowed years. The old oaks, which had seen Indians pass under their limbs, hugged the house closely with their great trunks and towered their branches over the roof in dense shade. The lawn, reclaimed from weeds, grew thick with clover and Bermuda grass, and Gerald saw to it that it was well kept. From the avenue of cedars to the row of white cabins in the slave quarters, there was an air of solidness, of stability and permanence about Tara. And whenever Gerald galloped around the bend in the road and saw his own roof rising through green branches, his heart swelled with pride, as though each sight of it were the first sight. He had done it all, little, hard-headed, blustering Gerald. Gerald was on excellent terms with all his neighbors in the county, except the McIntoshes, whose land adjoined his on the left, and the Slatteries, whose meager 3 acres stretched on his right along the swamp bottoms between the river and John Wilkes' plantation. The McIntoshes were Scotch-Irish and Orangemen, and had they possessed all the saintly qualities of the Catholic calendar, this ancestry would have damned them forever in Gerald's eyes. True, they had lived in Georgia for 70 years, and before that had spent a generation in the Carolinas. But the first of the family who set foot on American shores had come from Ulster. And that was enough for Gerald. They were a close-mouthed and stiff-necked family, who kept strictly to themselves and intermarried with their Carolina relatives. And Gerald was not alone in disliking them, for the county people were neighborly and sociable, and none too tolerant of anyone lacking in those same qualities. Rumors of abolitionist sympathies did not enhance the popularity of the McIntoshes. Old Angus had never manumitted a single slave, and had committed the unpardonable social breach of selling some of his Negroes to passing slave traders en route to the cane fields of Louisiana. But the rumors persisted. "He's an abolitionist, no doubt," observed Gerald to John Wilkes. "But in an Orangeman, when a principle comes up against Scotch tightness, the principle fares ill." The Slatteries were another affair. Being poor white, they were not even accorded the grudging respect that Angus McIntosh's dour independence wrung from neighboring families. Old Slattery, who clung persistently to his few acres, in spite of repeated offers from Gerald and John Wilkes, was shiftless and whining. His wife was a snarly-haired woman, sickly and washed out of appearance, the mother of a brood of sullen and rabbity-looking children, a brood which was increased regularly every year. Tom Slattery owned no slaves, and he and his 2 oldest boys spasmodically worked their few acres of cotton, while the wife and younger children tended what was supposed to be a vegetable garden. But somehow, the cotton always failed, and the garden, due to Mrs. Slattery's constant childbearing, seldom furnished enough to feed her flock. The sight of Tom Slattery dawdling on his neighbor's porches, begging cottonseed for planting or a side of bacon to tide him over, was a familiar one. Slattery hated his neighbors with what little energy he possessed, sensing their contempt beneath their courtesy. And especially did he hate rich folks' uppity niggers. The house negroes of the county considered themselves superior to white trash, and their unconcealed scorn stung him, while their more secure position in life stirred his envy. By contrast, with his own miserable existence, they were well-fed, well-clothed, and looked after in sickness and old age. They were proud of the good names of their owners, and for the most part, proud to belong to people who were quality, while he was despised by all. Tom Slattery could have sold his farm for 3 times its value to any of the planters in the county. They would have considered it money well spent to rid the community of an eyesore. But he was well satisfied to remain and to subsist miserably on the proceeds of a bale of cotton a year and the charity of his neighbors. With all the rest of the county, Gerald was on terms of amity and some intimacy. The Wilkeses, the Calverts, the Tarletons, the Fontaines all smiled when the small figure on the big white horse galloped up their driveways, smiled and signaled 4 tall glasses in which a pony of bourbon had been poured over a teaspoon of sugar and a sprig of crushed mint. Gerald was likable, and the neighbors learned in time what the children, negroes, and dogs discovered at first sight, that a kind heart, a ready and sympathetic ear, and an open pocketbook lurked just behind his bawling voice and his truculent manner. His arrival was always amid a bedlam of hounds barking, and small black children shouting as they raced to meet him, quarreling for the privilege of holding his horse, and squirming and grinning under his good-natured insults. The white children clamored to sit on his knee and be trotted, while he denounced to their elders the infamy of Yankee politicians. The daughters of his friends took him into their confidence about their love affairs. And the youths of the neighborhood, fearful of confessing debts of honor upon the carpets of their fathers, found him a friend in need.
"So you've been owing this for a month, you young rascal," he would shout. "And in God's name, why haven't you been asking me for the money before this?"
His rough manner of speech was too well known to give offense, and it only made the young men grin sheepishly and reply, "Well, sir, I hated to trouble you and my father.
Your father's a good man, and no denying it, but strict, and so take this, and let's be hearing no more of it."
The planters' ladies were the last to capitulate. But when Mrs. Wilkes, a great lady and with a rare gift for silence, as Gerald characterized her, told her husband one evening after Gerald's horse had pounded down the driveway, "He has a rough tongue, but he is a gentleman." Gerald had definitely arrived. He did not know that he had taken nearly 10 years to arrive, for it never occurred to him that his neighbors had eyed him askance at first. In his own mind, there had never been any doubt that he belonged, from the moment he first set foot on Terra. When Gerald was 43, so thick-set of body and florid of face that he looked like a hunting squire out of a sporting print, it came to him that Terra, dear though it was, and the county folk, with their open hearts and open houses, were not enough. He wanted a wife. Terra cried out for a mistress. The fat cook, a yard negro elevated by necessity to the kitchen, never had the meals on time. And the chambermaid, formerly a field hand, let dust accumulate on the furniture and never seemed to have clean linen on hand, so that the arrival of guests was always the occasion of much stirring and to-do. Pork, the only trained house negro on the place, had general supervision over the other servants, but even he had grown slack and careless after several years of exposure to Gerald's happy-go-lucky mode of living. As valet, he kept Gerald's bedroom in order, and as butler, he served the meals with dignity and style, but otherwise he pretty well let matters follow their own course. With unerring African instinct, the Negroes had all discovered that Gerald had a loud bark and no bite at all, and they took shameless advantage of him. The air was always thick with threats of selling slaves south and of direful whippings. But there had never been a slave sold from Terra, and only one whipping. And that administered for not grooming down Gerald's pet horse after a long day's hunting. Gerald's sharp blue eyes noticed how efficiently his neighbors' houses were run, and with what ease the smooth-haired wives in rustling skirts managed their servants. He had no knowledge of the dawn-till-midnight activities of these women, chained to supervision of cooking, nursing, sewing, and laundering. He only saw the outward results, and those results impressed him. The urgent need of a wife became clear to him one morning when he was dressing to ride to town for court day. Pork brought forth his favorite ruffled shirt, so inexpertly mended by the chambermaid as to be unwearable by anyone except his valet. "Mr. Gerald," said Pork, gratefully rolling up the shirt as Gerald fumed, "what you needs is a wife. And a wife what has got plenty of house niggers." Gerald upbraided Pork for his impertinence, but he knew that he was right. He wanted a wife, and he wanted children, and if he did not acquire them soon, it would be too late. But he was not going to marry just anyone, as Mr. Calvert had done, taking to wife the Yankee governess of his motherless children. His wife must be a lady, and a lady of blood, with as many airs and graces as Mrs. Wilkes, and the ability to manage Terra as well as Mrs. Wilkes ordered her own domain. But there were two difficulties in the way of marriage into the county families. The first was the scarcity of girls of marriageable age. The second, and more serious one, was that Gerald was a new man, despite his nearly 10 years' residence, and a foreigner. No one knew anything about his family. While the society of upcountry Georgia was not so impregnable as that of the coast aristocrats, no family wanted a daughter wed to a man about whose grandfather nothing was known. Gerald knew that despite the genuine liking of the county men with whom he hunted, drank, and talked politics, there was hardly one whose daughter he could marry. And he did not intend to have it gossiped about over supper tables that this, that, or the other father had regretfully refused to let Gerald O'Hara pay court to his daughter. This knowledge did not make Gerald feel inferior to his neighbors. Nothing could ever make Gerald feel that he was inferior, in any way, to anyone. It was merely a quaint custom of the county that daughters only married into families who had lived in the South much longer than 22 years, had owned land and slaves, and had been addicted only to the fashionable vices during that time. "Pack up! We're going to Savannah," he told Pork. "And if I hear you say whist or faith but once, it's selling you I'll be doing, for they are words I seldom say myself." James and Andrew might have some advice to offer on this subject of marriage. And there might be daughters among their old friends who would both meet his requirements and find him acceptable as a husband. James and Andrew listened to his story patiently, but they gave him little encouragement. They had no Savannah relatives to whom they might look for assistance, for they had been married when they came to America. And the daughters of their old friends had long since married and were raising small children of their own.
"You're not a rich man and you haven't a great family," said James.
"I've made me money and I can make a great family. And I won't be marrying just anyone."
"You fly high," observed Andrew, dryly.
But they did their best for Gerald. James and Andrew were old men, and they stood well in Savannah. They had many friends, and for a month they carried Gerald from home to home to suppers, dances, and picnics.
"There's only one who takes me high," Gerald said finally. "And she not even born when I landed here."
"And who is it takes your eye?"
"Miss Ellen Robillard," said Gerald, trying to speak casually, for the slightly tilting dark eyes of Ellen Robillard had taken more than his eye. Despite a mystifying listlessness of manner, so strange in a girl of 15, she charmed him. Moreover, there was a haunting look of despair about her that went to his heart and made him more gentle with her than he had ever been with any person in all the world.
"And you old enough to be her father,
and me in me prime," cried Gerald, stung.
James spoke gently.
"Jerry, there's no girl in Savannah you'd have less chance of marrying. Her father is a Robillard, and those French are proud as Lucifer, and her mother, God rest her soul, was a very great lady."
"I care not," said Gerald heatedly. "Besides, her mother is dead, and old man Robillard likes me. As a man, yes, but as a son-in-law, no."
"The girl wouldn't have you anyway," interposed Andrew. "She's been in love with that wild buck of a cousin of hers, Philippe Robillard, for a year now, despite her family being at her morning and night to give him up."
"He's been gone to Louisiana this month now," said Gerald.
"And how do you know?"
"I know,"
answered Gerald, who did not care to disclose that Pork had supplied this valuable bit of information, or that Philippe had departed for the West at the express desire of his family.
"And I do not think she's been so much in love with him that she won't forget him. 15 is too young to know much about love."
"They'd rather have that breakneck cousin for her than you."
So James and Andrew were as startled as anyone when the news came out that the daughter of Pierre Robillard was to marry the little Irishman from up the country. Savannah buzzed behind its doors and speculated about Philippe Robillard, who had gone west. But the gossiping brought no answer. Why the loveliest of the Robillard daughters should marry a loud-voiced, red-faced little man who came hardly up to her ears remained a mystery to all. Gerald himself never quite knew how it all came about. He only knew that a miracle had happened, and for once in his life he was utterly humble when Ellen, very white but very calm, put a light hand on his arm and said, "I will marry you, Mr. O'Hara." The thunderstruck Robillards knew the answer in part, but only Ellen and her mammy ever knew the whole story of the night when the girl sobbed till the dawn, like a broken-hearted child, and rose up in the morning, a woman with her mind made up. With foreboding, Mammy had brought her young mistress a small package, addressed in a strange hand from New Orleans, a package containing a miniature of Ellen, which she flung to the floor with a cry, 4 letters in her own handwriting to Philippe Robillard, and a brief letter from a New Orleans priest announcing the death of her cousin in a barroom brawl. "They drove him away, Father and Pauline and Eulalie. They drove him away. I hate them. I hate them all. I never want to see them again. I want to get away.
I will go away where I'll never see them again, or this town, or anyone who reminds me of him.
And when the night was nearly spent, Mammy, who had cried herself out over her mistress's dark head, protested,
"But, honey, you can't do that."
"I will do it. He's a kind man. I will do it. I'll go into the convent at Charleston."
It was the threat of the convent that finally won the assent of bewildered and heart-stricken Pierre Robillard. He was staunchly Presbyterian, even though his family were Catholic, and the thought of his daughter becoming a nun was even worse than that of her marrying Gerald O'Hara. After all, the man had nothing against him but a lack of family. So Ellen, no longer Robillard, turned her back on Savannah, never to see it again, and with a middle-aged husband, Mammy, and 20 house niggers, journeyed toward Tara. The next year, their first child was born, and they named her Katie Scarlet, after Gerald's mother. Gerald was disappointed, for he had wanted a son, but he nevertheless was pleased enough over his small, black-haired daughter to serve rum to every slave at Tara, and to get roaringly, happily drunk himself. If Ellen had ever regretted her sudden decision to marry him, no one ever knew it, certainly not Gerald, who almost burst with pride whenever he looked at her. She had put Savannah and its memories behind her when she left that gently mannered city by the sea, and from the moment of her arrival in the county, North Georgia was her home. When she departed from her father's house forever, she had left a home whose lines were as beautiful and flowing as a woman's body, as a ship in full sail. A pale pink stucco house built in the French colonial style, set high from the ground in a dainty manner, approached by swirling stairs, banistered with wrought iron as delicate as lace. A dim, rich house, gracious but aloof. She had left not only that graceful dwelling, but also the entire civilization that was behind the building of it. And she found herself in a world that was as strange and different as if she had crossed a continent. Here in North Georgia was a rugged section held by a hardy people. High up on the plateau at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains, she saw rolling red hills wherever she looked, with huge outcroppings of the underlying granite and gaunt pines towering somberly everywhere. It all seemed wild and untamed to her coast-bred eyes, accustomed to the quiet jungle beauty of the sea islands draped in their gray moss and tangled green, the white stretches of beach hot beneath a semi-tropic sun, the long flat vistas of sandy land studded with palmetto and palm. This was a section that knew the chill of winter as well as the heat of summer. And there was a vigor and energy in the people that was strange to her. They were a kindly people, courteous, generous, filled with abounding good nature, but sturdy, virile, easy to anger. The people of the coast, which she had left, might pride themselves on taking all of their affairs, even their duels and their feuds, with a careless air. But these North Georgia people had a streak of violence in them. On the coast, life had mellowed. Here it was young and lusty and new. All the people Ellen had known in Savannah might have been cast from the same mold, so similar were their viewpoints and traditions. But here was a variety of people. North Georgia settlers were coming in from many different places, from other parts of Georgia, from the Carolinas and Virginia, from Europe and the North. Some of them, like Gerald, were new people seeking their fortunes. Some, like Ellen, were members of old families who had found life intolerable in their former homes and sought haven in a distant land. Many had moved for no reason at all, except that the restless blood of pioneering fathers still quickened in their veins. These people, drawn from many different places and with many different backgrounds, gave the whole life of the county an informality that was new to Ellen, an informality to which she never quite accustomed herself. She instinctively knew how coast people would act in any circumstance. There was never any telling what North Georgians would do. And quickening all of the affairs of the section was the high tide of prosperity then rolling over the South. All of the world was crying out for cotton, and the new land of the county, unworn and fertile, produced it abundantly. Cotton was the heartbeat of the section. The planting and the picking were the diastole and the systole of the red earth. Wealth came out of the curving furrows, and arrogance came, too. Arrogance built on green bushes and the acres of fleecy white. If cotton could make them rich in one generation, how much richer they would be in the next. This certainty of the morrow gave zest and enthusiasm to life, and the county people enjoyed life with a heartiness that Ellen could never understand. They had money enough and slaves enough to give them time to play, and they liked to play. They seemed never too busy to drop work for a fish fry, a hunt or a horse race, and scarcely a week went by without its barbecue or ball. Ellen never would or could quite become one of them. She had left too much of herself in Savannah. But she respected them, and in time learned to admire the frankness and forthrightness of these people, who had few reticences, and who valued a man for what he was. She became the best-loved neighbor in the county. She was a thrifty and kind mistress, a good mother, and a devoted wife. The heartbreak and selflessness that she would have dedicated to the church were devoted instead to the service of her child, her household, and the man who had taken her out of Savannah and its memories, and had never asked any questions. When Scarlett was a year old, and more healthy and vigorous than a girl baby had any right to be, in Mammy's opinion, Ellen's second child, named Susan Eleanor, but always called Sue Ellen, was born, and in due time came Corrine, listed in the family Bible as Caroline Irene. Then followed three little boys, each of whom died before he had learned to walk. Three little boys who now lay under the twisted cedars in the burying ground, 100 yards from the house, beneath three stones, each bearing the name of Gerald O'Hara, Jr. From the day when Ellen first came to Tara, the place had been transformed. If she was only 15 years old, she was nevertheless ready for the responsibilities of the mistress of a plantation. Before marriage, young girls must be, above all other things, sweet, gentle, beautiful, and ornamental. But after marriage, they were expected to manage households that numbered 100 people or more, white and black, and they were trained with that in view. Ellen had been given this preparation for marriage, which any well-brought-up young lady received, and she also had Mammy, who could galvanize the most shiftless Negro into energy. She quickly brought order, dignity, and grace into Gerald's household, and she gave Tara a beauty it had never had before. The house had been built according to no architectural plan whatever, with extra rooms added where and when it seemed convenient, but with Ellen's care and attention, it gained a charm that made up for its lack of design. The avenue of cedars leading from the main road to the house, that avenue of cedars without which no Georgia planter's home could be complete, had a cool, dark shadiness that gave a brighter tinge by contrast to the green of the other trees. The wisteria, tumbling over the verandas, showed bright against the whitewashed brick, and it joined with the pink crepe myrtle bushes by the door and the white-blossomed magnolias in the yard to disguise some of the awkward lines of the house. In springtime and summer, the Bermuda grass and clover on the lawn became emerald, so enticing an emerald that it presented an irresistible temptation to the flocks of turkeys and white geese that were supposed to roam only the regions in the rear of the house. The elders of the flocks continually led stealthy advances into the front yard, lured on by the green of the grass and the luscious promise of the Cape jessamine buds and the zinnia beds. Against their depredations, a small black sentinel was stationed on the front porch. Armed with a ragged towel, the little Negro boy sitting on the steps was part of the picture of Tara. And an unhappy one, for he was forbidden to chunk the fowls and could only flap the towel at them and shoo them. Ellen set dozens of little black boys to this task, the first position of responsibility a male slave had at Terra. After they had passed their 10th year, they were sent to Old Daddy, the plantation cobbler, to learn his trade, or to Amos, the wheelwright and carpenter, or to Philip, the cowman, or Cuffy, the mule boy. If they showed no aptitude for any of these trades, they became field hands, and, in the opinion of the Negroes, they had lost their claim to any social standing at all. Ellen's life was not easy, nor was it happy. But she did not expect life to be easy, and if it was not happy, that was woman's lot. It was a man's world, and she accepted it as such. The man owned the property, and the woman managed it. The man took the credit for the management, and the woman praised his cleverness. The man roared like a bull when a splinter was in his finger, and the woman muffled the moans of childbirth, lest she disturb him. Men were rough of speech and often drunk. Women ignored the lapses of speech and put the drunkards to bed without bitter words. Men were rude and outspoken. Women were always kind, gracious, and forgiving. She had been reared in the tradition of great ladies, which had taught her how to carry her burden and still retain her charm, and she intended that her three daughters should be great ladies also. With her younger daughters, she had success, for Sue Ellen was so anxious to be attractive she lent an attentive and obedient ear to her mother's teachings. And Corrine was shy and easily led, but Scarlet, child of Gerald, found the road to ladyhood hard. To Mammy's indignation, her preferred playmates were not her demure sisters or the well-brought-up Wilkes girls, but the Negro children on the plantation and the boys of the neighborhood, and she could climb a tree or throw a rock as well as any of them. Mammy was greatly perturbed that Ellen's daughter should display such traits, and frequently adjured her to act like a little lady. But Ellen took a more tolerant and long-sighted view of the matter. She knew that from childhood playmates grew beaux in later years, and the first duty of a girl was to get married. She told herself that the child was merely full of life, and there was still time in which to teach her the arts and graces of being attractive to men. To this end, Ellen and Mammy bent their efforts, and as Scarlet grew older, she became an apt pupil in this subject, even though she learned little else. Despite a succession of governesses and 2 years at the nearby Fayetteville Female Academy, her education was sketchy. But no girl in the county danced more gracefully than she. She knew how to smile so that her dimples leaped, how to walk pigeon-toed so that her wide hoop skirts swayed entrancingly, how to look up into a man's face and then drop her eyes and bat the lids rapidly so that she seemed a-tremble with gentle emotion. Most of all, she learned how to conceal from men a sharp intelligence beneath a face as sweet and bland as a baby's. Ellen, by soft-voiced admonition, and Mammy, by constant carping, labored to inculcate in her the qualities that would make her truly desirable as a wife. "You must be more gentle, dear,"
more sedate, Ellen told her daughter. You must not interrupt gentlemen when they are speaking, even if you do think you know more about matters than they do. Gentlemen do not like forward girls.
Young Miss What frowns and pushes out their chins and says, I will and I won't, most generally don't kitch husbands, prophesied Mammy gloomily. Young Misses should cast down their eyes and say, Well, sir, I'm out, and just as you say, sir.
Between them, they taught her all that a gentlewoman should know, but she learned only the outward signs of gentility. The inner grace from which these signs should spring. She never learned, nor did she see any reason for learning it. Appearances were enough, for the appearances of ladyhood won her popularity, and that was all she wanted. Gerald bragged that she was the belle of 5 counties, and with some truth, for she had received proposals from nearly all the young men in the neighborhood, and many from places as far away as Atlanta and Savannah. At 16, thanks to Mammy and Ellen, she looked sweet, charming, and giddy. But she was, in reality, self-willed, vain, and obstinate. She had the easily stirred passions of her Irish father, and nothing except the thinnest veneer of her mother's unselfish and forbearing nature. Ellen never fully realized that it was only a veneer, for Scarlett always showed her best face to her mother, concealing her escapades, curbing her temper, and appearing as sweet-natured as she could in Ellen's presence. For her mother could shame her to tears with a reproachful glance. But Mammy was under no illusions about her, and was constantly alert for breaks in the veneer. Mammy's eyes were sharper than Ellen's, and Scarlett could never recall in all her life having fooled Mammy for long. It was not that these two loving mentors deplored Scarlett's high spirits, vivacity, and charm. These were traits of which Southern women were proud. It was Gerald's headstrong and impetuous nature in her that gave them concern, and they sometimes feared that they would not be able to conceal her damaging qualities until she had made a good match. But Scarlett intended to marry, and marry Ashley. And she was willing to appear demure, pliable, and scatterbrained, if those were the qualities that attracted men. Just why men should be this way, she did not know. She only knew that such methods worked. It never interested her enough to try to think out the reason for it, for she knew nothing of the inner workings of any human being's mind, not even her own. She knew only that if she did or said thus and so, men would unerringly respond with a complimentary thus and so. It was like a mathematical formula, and no more difficult, for mathematics was the one subject that had come easy to Scarlett in her school days. If she knew little about men's minds, she knew even less about the minds of women, for they interested her less. She had never had a girlfriend, and she never felt any lack on that account. To her, all women, including her 2 sisters, were natural enemies in pursuit of the same prey, man. All women, with the one exception of her mother. Ellen O'Hara was different. And Scarlett regarded her as something holy and apart from all the rest of humankind. When Scarlett was a child, she had confused her mother with the Virgin Mary, and now that she was older, she saw no reason for changing her opinion. To her, Ellen represented the utter security that only heaven or a mother can give. She knew that her mother was the embodiment of justice, truth, loving tenderness, and profound wisdom. A great lady. Scarlett wanted very much to be like her mother. The only difficulty was that, by being just and truthful and tender and unselfish, one missed most of the joys of life, and certainly many beaux. And life was too short to miss such pleasant things. Some day when she was married to Ashley and old, some day when she had time for it, she intended to be like Ellen, but until
then.
Chapter 4. That night at supper, Scarlet went through the motions of presiding over the table in her mother's absence. But her mind was in a ferment over the dreadful news she had heard about Ashley and Melanie. Desperately, she longed for her mother's return from the Slatteries, for without her, she felt lost and alone. What right had the Slatteries and their everlasting sickness to take Ellen away from home just at this time when she, Scarlet, needed her so much? Throughout the dismal meal, Gerald's booming voice battered against her ears until she thought she could endure it no longer. He had forgotten completely about his conversation with her that afternoon, and was carrying on a monologue about the latest news from Fort Sumter, which he punctuated by hammering his fist on the table and waving his arms in the air. Gerald made a habit of dominating the conversation at mealtimes, and usually Scarlet, occupied with her own thoughts, scarcely heard him. But tonight, she could not shut out his voice, no matter how much she strained to listen for the sound of carriage wheels, that would herald Ellen's return. Of course, she did not intend to tell her mother what was so heavy on her heart, for Ellen would be shocked and grieved to know that a daughter of hers wanted a man who was engaged to another girl. But in the depths of the first tragedy she had ever known, she wanted the very comfort of her mother's presence. She always felt secure when Ellen was by her, for there was nothing so bad that Ellen could not better it, simply by being there. She rose suddenly from her chair at the sound of creaking wheels in the driveway, and then sank down again as they went on around the house to the backyard. It could not be Ellen, for she would alight at the front steps. Then there was an excited babble of Negro voices in the darkness of the yard, and high-pitched Negro laughter. Looking out the window, Scarlet saw Pork, who had left the room a moment before, holding high a flaring pine knot, while indistinguishable figures descended from a wagon. The laughter and talking rose and fell in the dark night air, pleasant, homely, carefree sounds, gutturally soft, musically shrill. Then feet shuffled up the back porch stairs and into the passageway leading to the main house, stopping in the hall just outside the dining room. There was a brief interval of whispering, and Pork entered, his usual dignity gone, his eyes rolling and his teeth agleam.
"Mr. Gerald," he announced, breathing hard, the pride of a bridegroom all over his shining face. "Your new woman done come." "New woman? I didn't buy any new woman," declared Gerald, pretending to glare. "Yes, sir, you did, Mr. Gerald. Yes, sir. And she out here now, wanting to speak with you,"
answered Pork, giggling and twisting his hands in excitement.
"Well, bring in the bride," said Gerald.
And Pork, turning, beckoned into the hall to his wife, newly arrived from the Wilkes plantation, to become part of the household of Tara. She entered, and behind her, almost hidden by her voluminous calico skirts, came her 12-year-old daughter squirming against her mother's legs. Dilsey was tall and bore herself erectly. She might have been any age, from 30 to 60, so unlined was her immobile bronze face. Indian blood was plain in her features, overbalancing the Negroid characteristics. The red color of her skin, narrow high forehead, prominent cheekbones, and the hawk-bridged nose which flattened at the end above thick Negro lips all showed the mixture of two races. She was self-possessed and walked with a dignity that surpassed even Mammy's. For Mammy had acquired her dignity, and Dilsey's was in her blood. When she spoke, her voice was not so slurred as most Negroes, and she chose her words more carefully.
"Good evening, young missus. Mr. Gerald, I'm sorry to disturb you, but I wanted to come here and thank you again for buying me and my child. Lots of gentlemen's might have bought me, but they wouldn't have bought my Prissy, too, just to keep me from grieving, and I thanks you. I'm going to do my best for you, and show you I ain't forgetting.
said Gerald, clearing his throat in embarrassment at being caught openly in an act of kindness. Dilsey turned to Scarlet, and something like a smile wrinkled the corners of her eyes.
"Miss Scarlet, Pock done told me how you asked Mr. Gerald to buy me. And so I'm going to give you my prissy for your own maid."
She reached behind her and jerked the little girl forward. She was a brown little creature, with skinny legs like a bird and a myriad of pigtails carefully wrapped with twine sticking stiffly out from her head. She had sharp, knowing eyes that missed nothing and a studiedly stupid look on her face. "Thank you, Dilsey," Scarlet replied. "But I'm afraid Mammy will have something to say about that. She's been my maid ever since I was born."
"Mammy getting old," said Dilsey,
with a calmness that would have enraged Mammy.
"She a good Mammy, but you a young lady now, and needs a good maid. And my prissy been maiden for Miss India for a year now. She can sew and fix hair good as a grown person."
Prodded by her mother, Prissy bobbed a sudden curtsy and grinned at Scarlet, who could not help grinning back. "A sharp little wench," she thought, and said aloud, "Thank you, Dilsey. We'll see about it when Mother comes home."
"Thank you, ma'am.
I gives you good night," said Dilsey. And turning, left the room with her child, Pork dancing attendance. The supper things cleared away. Gerald resumed his oration, but with little satisfaction to himself and none at all to his audience. His thunderous predictions of immediate war and his rhetorical questions as to whether the South would stand for further insults from the Yankees only produced faintly bored, "Yes, papas," and "No, pas." Corrine, sitting on a hassock under the big lamp, was deep in the romance of a girl who had taken the veil after her lover's death, and with silent tears of enjoyment oozing from her eyes, was pleasurably picturing herself in a white coif. Sue Ellen, embroidering on what she gigglingly called her hope chest, was wondering if she could possibly detach Stuart Tarleton from her sister's side at the barbecue tomorrow and fascinate him with the sweet womanly qualities which she possessed and Scarlet did not. And Scarlet was in a tumult about Ashley. How could Pa talk on and on about Fort Sumter and the Yankees when he knew her heart was breaking? As usual in the very young, she marveled that people could be so selfishly oblivious to her pain, and the world rock along just the same in spite of her heartbreak. Her mind was as if a cyclone had gone through it, and it seemed strange that the dining room where they sat should be so placid, so unchanged from what it had always been. The heavy mahogany table and sideboards, the massive silver, the bright rag rugs on the shining floor were all in their accustomed places, just as if nothing had happened. It was a friendly and comfortable room, and ordinarily Scarlet loved the quiet hours which the family spent there after supper. But tonight she hated the sight of it, and if she had not feared her father's loudly bawled questions, she would have slipped away, down the dark hall to Ellen's little office, and cried out her sorrow on the old sofa. That was the room that Scarlet liked best in all the house. There, Ellen sat before her tall secretary each morning, keeping the accounts of the plantation and listening to the reports of Jonas Wilkerson, the overseer. There also the family idled while Ellen's quill scratched across her ledgers, Gerald in the old rocker, the girls on the sagging cushions of the sofa that was too battered and worn for the front of the house. Scarlet longed to be there now, alone with Ellen, so she could put her head in her mother's lap and cry in peace. Wouldn't Mother ever come home? Then wheels ground sharply on the graveled driveway, and the soft murmur of Ellen's voice dismissing the coachman floated into the room. The whole group looked up eagerly as she entered rapidly, her hoops swaying, her face tired and sad.
There entered with her the faint fragrance of lemon verbena sachet, which seemed always to creep from the folds of her dresses, a fragrance that was always linked in Scarlett's mind with her mother. Mammy followed at a few paces, the leather bag in her hand, her underlip pushed out and her brow lowering. Mammy muttered darkly to herself as she waddled, taking care that her remarks were pitched too low to be understood, but loud enough to register her unqualified disapproval. "I am sorry I am so late," said Ellen, slipping her plaid shawl from drooping shoulders and handing it to Scarlett, whose cheek she patted in passing. Gerald's face had brightened, as if by magic, at her entrance.
"Is the brat baptized?" he questioned.
"Yes, and dead, poor thing," said Ellen. "I feared Emmy would die, too, but I think she will live."
The girls' faces turned to her, startled and questioning,
and Gerald wagged his head philosophically. "Well, 'tis better so that the brat is dead, no doubt. Poor fatherless,
it is late. We had better have prayers now," interrupted Ellen so smoothly that, if Scarlett had not known her mother well, the interruption would have passed unnoticed. It would be interesting to know who was the father of Emmy Slattery's baby, but Scarlett knew she would never learn the truth of the matter if she waited to hear it from her mother. Scarlett suspected Jonas Wilkerson, for she had frequently seen him walking down the road with Emmy at nightfall. Jonas was a Yankee and a bachelor, and the fact that he was an overseer forever barred him from any contact with a county social life. There was no family of any standing into which he could marry, no people with whom he could associate except the Slatteries and riffraff like them. As he was several cuts above the Slatteries in education, it was only natural that he should not want to marry Emmy, no matter how often he might walk with her in the twilight. Scarlett sighed, for her curiosity was sharp. Things were always happening under her mother's eyes, which she noticed no more than if they had not happened at all. Ellen ignored all things contrary.